Okay, thank you. Thanks to the organizers for the invitation to give this talk, and to Michael for the extra 5 minutes that I'm definitely going to use. So I want to talk about tensor networks as path integral geometry, and what that means hopefully will become clear at some point. And this is joint work with Ash Milstead, who is a postdoc at Perimeter Institute. So Michael again introduced tensor networks. Here I just want to say that, as you know, because you learned it in the previous talk, tensor networks are an efficient representation and also an efficient framework to manipulate a number of objects of interest, including many body wave functions. And in this case, we can think of a matrix product state or a multi-scale entanglement ring normalization ANSETS or a projected entanglement pair state and so on. We have a number of such tensor networks that we use on a regular basis as variational ANSETS for many body systems. We can also use tensor networks to codify or to write efficiently Euclidean path integrals or partition functions, and then we can, for instance, apply a ring normalization group transformation. So, what I want to discuss today is that sometimes, or actually quite often, the word geometry appears in relation to tensor networks. For instance, if I give you a two-dimensional partition function on a cylinder, on a lattice that lives on the cylinder, well, I just told you this has a geometry of a cylinder, okay? There is other interesting tensor networks. We have the happy coat, or we've heard about the Mera. And in these cases, everybody will say, yes, that's hyperbolic space. And to me, this, you know, I don't object to saying such things, but I never really understood what that meant at a deeper level, perhaps. But in any case, tensor networks might be related to geometry. And a question you may ask is, OK, so what? Why is this interesting? And I could come up with two answers for this. One is that serious answers for this. One is that geometry contains structural information about the wave function. So for instance, if I give you a wave function of n quantum spins, spin 1/2 degrees of freedom, then if I tell you that it can be represented as a matrix product state, I'm assuming here a very large system, translation invariant, I'm using finite bond dimension, automatically, from knowledge that this wave function can be represented as a matrix product state, I learned that the correlations in this wave function decay at long distances exponentially. I learned that this wave function, the entropy in this wave function, the entropy of a single interval is upper bounded by a constant. I learned a number of things, okay? Similarly, if I'm being told, well, I don't know what the wave function is, but it can be represented as a Mera, again, homogeneous Mera, then automatically I learned that this wave function has power law decay of correlations, and this wave function has the entropy of an interval that scales at most as logarithmically in the size of the interval. So there is structural information about the wave function that I learned just by knowing that this wave function is represented as a given tensor network. And all this information comes from the geometry of this tensor network. All this information comes from how the tensors are connected into a tensor network, okay? Very good. And this, you want to compare it to the situation where I just say, here's your 2 to the n coefficients of the wave function. Of course, if I give you 2 to the n coefficients, I give you all the information. You could compute anything you want, maybe not efficiently, but you could in principle. You could determine how the correlations look like, how the entropy scales, but you would not be able to deduce this just from the fact that you have a tensor with, you know, n indices, right? So the package, the format in which I give you the wave function will not tell you anything about the wave function itself. Very good. So the geometry is interesting because the geometry of a tensor network may inform us about structural properties of the object that the tensor network is representing. Is that moment, John? Is that moment? Okay. Good. Holography. So another context in which geometry and tensor networks appear together is that of holography, especially thanks to Brian Swingle, who conjectured that Mera could be interpreted as a time slice of ADS3. And so in this sense, the Mera would be a hyperbolic disk. And then more recently, there is the conjecture that maybe Mera is representing a discrete version of kinematic space, which would be the integral transform. which would mean that instead of the hyperbolic disk, we would be talking about the sitter 2. It doesn't matter. The point is that there is a geometry attached to the tensor network. Okay? And so what I would like to understand is, what does it mean that a tensor network is attached to a geometry, or that we can attach a geometry to a tensor network? That's what I would like to understand. And I'm not going to give you a final answer, but I'm going to give you a specific ways in which we can attach a geometric meaning to a tensor network. Okay? So I don't know the absolute truth, but I know a couple of examples of situations where we can say that there is a geometry attached to a tensor network, a concrete sense in which this happens. All right, so I want to talk about pure geometry. I want to understand in which sense a tensor network can be understood as representing a geometry. And I also want to talk about later about how, in which sense a tensor network might be representing a path integral geometry, where I will have to define this. So let me start with a geometry. So I had to learn a lot of geometry. Apparently, you can have a two-dimensional manifold representing Euclidean spacetime. Euclidean spacetime in two dimensions, obviously. And then what you can do is you can get a set of coordinates, tau and x. So tau would be representing Euclidean time, x would be representing positions, and we can use that to cover our manifold. And so points in the manifold, this point here, will come with a coordinate tau 0 and x 0, okay, and so on. And on top of that, we have a metric. Okay, so we have a metric. We'll have some other object which tells us about neighboring points, how far away they are from each other. Very good. So what we could do is the following. We could consider, I want to discretize this object and then use a tensor network to describe this discretized manifold. So a way I could do that, perhaps, is by taking the coordinates, and instead of allowing x, tau and x to take continuous values, I could just assume that they can only take integer values. Automatically I get a grid on the manifold. And now I'm going to imagine that on each point on this grid, well, I attach a tensor, and this tensor is going to represent a patch of the spacetime, of the Euclidean spacetime. Okay? So I'm going to cover the manifold with a grid, and I'm just going to break the manifold according to this grid. Okay. So I do that. And now I throw away the manifold, I just keep the grid. And this might be dangerous. For instance, if my tensors are all identical, okay, and I always get a grid which is characterized by integer numbers, so suddenly I've thrown away the information about the metric, right? So if each tensor is equivalent, then we lost the metric, actually. I always end up with flat spacetime. So I have to be careful. I have to put back in information about the metric in one way or another. And that's what I want to do today. But first, let me tell you how I'm not going to do that. So remember, a tensor, from now on, a tensor, at least for the first half of this talk, a tensor is a patch of flat spacetime. And if I put many tensors together, then I get a bigger patch of flat spacetime. Okay? But I could also start playing around with the way I connect the same tensor. So I just have this type of tensor, many copies of it, and I can start connecting it in different ways, and maybe I can create a deficit angle or maybe an excess angle, and it really depends on how much time you have to waste preparing this talk. It's drawing, you know, it's nice at the end, but it takes some time. Anyway, I stop there because this is not how I want to proceed today. I don't want to start placing back a metric or curvature by playing around with the connectivity of a single type of tensor. I want to do something else. So let me remember what I want to do. I want to focus on two different ways of discretizing the manifold. One, I'm going to call it scale discretization. Okay, and there will be a tensor network that will look something like this at the end. And then I want also to talk about lattice and shift discretization, and then this will end up with a sequence of pieces of network that look like that. Okay? Good. So let me start with the scale discretization. So I want to start again with a continuous manifold with a metric, and I want to end up with a tensor network. And the way I wanted to do that is by using that in two dimensions. If I have at least locally a region of my manifold, I'm going to assume that it's topologically a disk. And then there is the result that says that with a Euclidean metric, that I can always choose coordinates tau and x. There is a choice of coordinates tau and x such that my metric is going to look very, very simple. Okay? My metric will be proportional to delta. And that's good because deltas are very easy, I mean, to represent. There is no information in the delta. All the information we're left with is in this scale factor in front of the delta. So I'm going to use that. Imagine that this is some region of your manifold. This is x, this is tau, so we're using these coordinates. And all we need to worry about is this scale factor. This scale factor characterizes this geometry, at least in this, for these values of x and tau. Very good. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to consider a discretization of that. There goes another half an hour of preparing the talk. Okay, so let me play it again, at least. Wow. So what I've done here is I've gone from a continuous scale factor, okay, so this, the scale factor in front of delta of the metric changes continuously with the coordinates. I go from there to a situation where it only changes discretely. I only allow it to take some values. And these values happen to be whatever, I don't know, some really ugly values. But they are equally spaced, so the phi here is equally spaced. Okay, so it only takes n times log 2 values, n being an integer. So this also means that, you know, this will happen at discrete values of x and tau, but you get the picture, right? So I go from a continuous situation to a discrete situation. That's, of course, an approximation that I could try to refine more and more. But let's continue with this. And now what I'm going to do is, well, first, as I said, the metric, the discrete metric now takes the form delta and then some 4 to the n, where n is an integer. And this n changes abruptly as we go around the manifold. Okay? Good. So, for instance, down here, what we have is a region of flat geometry. So all this is flat geometry now. With a metric which is proportional to delta with a factor 1. Whereas here we have another region which is, again, flat geometry with a metric which is, again, delta with a factor 1 over 4 and so on. Okay? Good. So here's a tensor network now. I'm going to take these pieces. I'm going to replace each square patch with my favorite blue ball tensor. Okay? And then I'm going to connect different pieces, different flat regions, this one at some scale with that one at another scale by means of additional tensors that will tell me how to connect, you know, this tensor with these two tensors and so on. Okay, so what we have is a new tensor network. This tensor network now, each tensor represents, again, a patch of flat spacetime. And we have a second set of sensors, these yellow tensors, or Ws, that glue, that what they do is they form some kind of glue that allow us to put together different flat spacetime regions. Okay? And a technical comment is that I've chosen just this tensor for simplicity, but those who know where this is going, I would use, instead of just these Ws, I would use a double layer of tensors, which would include these untanglers and this story. But at this point, this story is not obvious. I'm just dealing with the geometry at the moment. I don't have degrees of freedom, quantum degrees of freedom yet in. Okay? But there is a choice. I could have chosen to use this more complicated way of gluing different regions of flat spacetime. Very good. So this is a way in which we could discretize the geometry and produce a tensor network out of it. So if somebody gives me a tensor network that looks like that, okay, and for instance, Bartacek gave me once a network that looks like that, then I would say, okay, I know what that means. That this defines a discrete, a discretized geometry.
Sorry, but locally there is no difference between the different levels, right? Like a blue tensor is a blue tensor no matter where it is.
That's right.
So locally you can't measure the metric.
No, what you would do is you would see how the density of blue balls, right? Yeah. So for instance, to go from here to here, I have to jam 1, 2, 3, 4 blue balls. for what would look the same distance, if I try here, there is only one, and up there, there is none, right? So this informs me of this. All the information is in this scale factor, and now it's codified in this way. Okay? Very good. Good. So that was a way of getting a tensor network. Now there is another one, and it's related, but it's not equivalent. So this one is going to be lapse and shift discretization. So again, we have our manifold with a metric. And now what I want to focus on is on time slices. I want to take an initial time slice, this sigma, another time slice, sigma prime. Okay. So this, the first one corresponds to tau equal to some value tau 0. The second one is tau equal to tau 1, and so on. Okay, and I want to ask the following. I want to ask, how do I go from tau to tau prime? Sorry, how do I go from sigma, right, the first time slice, to the second one? And of course, I can follow the coordinates. This is x equal to x0, constant x0. I could follow the coordinates. But what I want is to also encode the information about the metric. And there is a standard way of doing that, and it's called the lapse and the lapse and shift formalism. And so what I'm going to do is I'm going to look at going first, instead of following the coordinate x equal to x1, which would turn to the left, I'm just going to go straight normal to this sigma, to the surface, to the time slice. Okay, I depart from the time slice orthogonal to it. And when I hit sigma prime, then I look at how much I have to turn to the left. Okay, so I repeat this here. I go straight, what's called a lapse. I measure if I go straight and normal to sigma. If I go straight, I measure this lapse function is going to tell me what's the distance before I hit sigma prime. And then there is this other function, beta shift, beta of x, which is going to tell me how much I have to turn to the left or to the right to follow the coordinates. So that's standard. Those of you who know a bit of geometry know about this. And what I want to do now is I'm going to break this into two pieces. I'm just going to go first lapse and then shift. Okay. So imagine the lapse is really moving in Euclidean time. You move in Euclidean time. And the shift is just once you are done moving in Euclidean time, you just try within the new time slice, you try to shift the coordinates. Okay, so I could do the two things separately, first the lapse and then the shift. And I'm just going to build a tensor network discrete version of this. And that's how I'm going to do it. For the discrete lapse, right, instead of following this shape here, I'm just going to follow some discrete shape, where I'm going to use the blue balls again to progress in Euclidean time. And there will be some extra tensors at the boundary, but that's not important for the time being. So the idea is that I can discretize the lapse, and I can discretize the shift. So for the shift, I'm just going to have to reorganize my degrees of freedom in some way. Okay. And so this is the second characterization I wanted to discuss. Yeah. And the point is that so far, I haven't talked about quantum mechanics. I haven't talked about the motivation to use tensor networks. Tensor networks are supposed to describe efficiently wave functions, partition functions, but we didn't have that here, okay? Just purely geometrically. So what I want to do next is actually to move to this path integral geometry. I want to take these two pictures that I just presented and modify them so that now our starting point is not just a manifold with a metric, but we want to have some field degree of freedom defined on top of the metric. And in particular, we want to have an Euclidean path integral, which is what that is this sum over all possible field configurations weighted by some Euclidean action, the exponential of an Euclidean action. And you could think of this as, say, being a free scalar massless field in two dimensions. So the metric, the field theory knows about the metric. This field degrees of freedom know that they live in a metric on top of a metric, and that's represented here through in the Euclidean path integral. Okay, so the idea is that usually we use tensor networks to represent discrete versions of such things. Okay, And now what I want to do is, well, I want to go again through the two representations, discrete geometry representations that I introduced, but of course we don't want to waste too much time, so I'm just going to tell you the changes. What I've been calling a tensor A before was just a patch of flat Euclidean spacetime. I used that tensor to represent a patch of Euclidean spacetime. And now what I'm going to say is, no, from now on, the same tensor actually means something else. What it means now is a path integral. It's a path integral on that patch of flat spacetime. Okay? So there was something interesting about before. We had indices here, which we were just using to connect different tensors, but the indices themselves did not contain degrees of freedom. Now, in the presence of a field, we will think of these indices actually as really taking the field configuration. So if this tensor is a patch of Euclidean path integral, then this index here contains the or labels the different field configurations of the field at this boundary. This index labels the different field configurations of the field on this boundary and so on. Okay? So now we have a much more complex object. We have a geometry, and on top of it we have some many-body system in the form of a field theory. Okay, so then we had these tensors, and then we had these other tensors, which I said had to do with how to glue together different patches of flat Euclidean spacetime. And so these guys, geometrically, they were just rescaling coordinates at a fixed time slice. They were just shifting the space at fixed time. But now they have to do much more. They have to not just rescale the coordinates as before, but they also have to rescale the fields that live in those indices. Okay, so we have field degrees of freedom, and we need to also do something about them when we go from one patch of flat spacetime to another one. Very good. So it's getting complicated, but we're almost there. Because and from now on, I'm just going to focus on this lapse and shift representation for simplicity and to be able to finish on time. Yeah. So I'm going to make a claim. Okay, and if you get the claim out of this talk, that's good enough. So what I'm going to claim is that we can use tensors, these three tensors, A, W, and U. Here I didn't say it, but these tensors really are the meta tensors, the tensors that you use in meta. Okay, this could come from some numerical optimization, blah, blah, blah. I'm not referring to that, to how to do that, but imagine you have tensors coming from meta. Well, we can put these guys together. Okay, and actually, the claim is that we can use these tensors to apply geometric gates in the Hilbert space of a time slice. So what does this mean? Remember, in the quantum case, what we have is that every time we have a time slice, there is a Hilbert space, right? There is a Hilbert space for your field degrees of freedom. And what you could ask is, can we use this tensor network or this tensors to implement geometric transformations on this Hilbert space? And what do I mean by geometric transformations? Well, I mean what you would have in the continuum. In the continuum, if you have a time slice and another one, you have the stuff in between, the Euclidean path integral between the two time slices defines a map, a linear map in the Hilbert space, and it's actually this is the type of geometrical transformation that I mean. So in a quantum field theory, we would know what this map is doing. And the question is whether we can see these guys doing exactly the same in the discrete. And I saw two people nodding positively, so that's good. All right, so example, right? An example would be the claim would be that I apply these blue balls here, and this should represent a lapse or an Euclidean time evolution on the Hilbert space. But I could do that in this space-dependent way, and that would be an inhomogeneous Euclidean time evolution in the Hilbert space. Okay? These are claims. I'm just breaking the claim into pieces. I'm saying that the hope is that if we are to attach some geometrical meaning to these tensors in the tensor network, that this would be an expectation that when you apply a homogeneous strip of blue balls, you would be applying a homogeneous Euclidean time evolution in the Hilbert space. When you take your Hilbert space and apply this inhomogeneous Euclidean time evolution, well, that this type of network would indeed evolve in Euclidean time by an amount that depends on where you are in the quantum system. And the same for rescaling. So we could apply a global rescaling. This should be applying a scale transformation to all the Hilbert space, but we could also try to apply it locally. Okay? And so the expectation, what I'm trying to test here is whether it is true that whether this claim is correct, whether we have a way of taking tensor networks and viewing them as generating some representation of geometrical gates in the Hilbert space of the theory. Very good. So for the rest of the talk, so the next 5 minutes, 10 minutes, I want to provide evidence that this claim is correct. Okay, that this is how it works. So I want to show that this type of tensor networks, when you can view them as gates acting on a Hilbert space, and that they are implementing this type of geometric gates. So what's the plan? The plan is to take a quantum spin chain as a lattice version of a quantum field theory. So our CAD here, our Hilbert space, is not going to be a continuum, but it's going to be we'll have the Hilbert space of a spin chain. Specifically, we'll have the low energy states of a spin chain, okay? And the problem is I want to show that this type of gates are going to implement geometric transformations in this Hilbert space, in the low energy states of a spin chain. That's what I would like to do. But actually, I don't know what that means. I don't know how to transform the low energy states of a spin chain in general, but I know how they transform for a critical quantum spin chain, because that the low energy subspace corresponds to a CFT. And for a CFT, it turns out that all these geometric gates I'm interested in correspond to conformal transformations. Okay, so here's the plan. I'm going to consider a quantum spin chain at criticality, so that's my lattice version of a CFT, and I'm going to apply gates like that, and I'm going to see whether the low energy states transform as they would under conformal transformations. Okay, so there is a plan. At least there is a plan. Very good. And so now that's what I need to do. And so we have the criticalizing model. We can start. So how do we get this tensor? Well, I'll work with the criticalizing model. Here's the Hamiltonian, the one-dimensional criticalized quantum spin chain. And from this Hamiltonian, there is an algorithm that I cannot detail, but it's well understood in the community to generate this tensor. Okay, so there is a way of generating this blue ball. And now I'm going to throw away this information, and from now on, all that I have available is this tensor. Okay, so my input from now on is just some tensor that we want to think that represents a patch of Euclidean path integral. And for instance, if we take this tensor and we connect it as a transfer matrix or as a ring, okay, so this connected with that, then this defines a transfer metric which should correspond to the exponential of minus the Hamiltonian. And in particular, for a critical system, that has to do with generators of conformal transformations, L0 and L0 bar, so rescaling. And in any case, what we know is that CFT tells us what to expect, what the spectrum of this object should be. And similarly, for a translation, we have now, say, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 sites, and we can apply a translation, a cyclic translation. Imagine that these 8 spins are on a ring, and so that would be translating, shifting the ring by one side. And equally well, the conformal field theory tells us what to expect for the eigenvalues of this momentum. Right. Very good. So there is a prediction from CFT, and indeed, if you go and build this object, this tensor, and you put 8 of them together, or in this case, 24 of them together, you build this transfer matrix, and then you build this translation operator. They commute. You can geometrically see that they commute. And so you can diagonalize them simultaneously, and you can plot the low energy spectrum of this lattice construction. Remember, this is just a lattice construction. But those of you who know CFT, you will recognize the spectrum of scaling dimensions and conformal spins of the Ising model. actually the low energy, the low energy of this problem is organized according to the scaling dimensions and conformal spins. So the scaling dimensions and conformal spins of the corresponding CFT, and in particular we have here three conformal towers, identity tower, the spin tower, and the energy density. And so we have a control environment. This is behaving as if it was a continuum theory. Okay. So now we are ready to see whether our gates that we build with tensors, transform this space as we would have in the continuum. So we continue with this example with the IC model. As I said, there are two conformal towers. And the first thing that this means is that so conformal towers are not mixed by this geometric or conformal transformation. What that means is that here, let me see. For instance, we have the conformal tower of the identity. It means that there is a low energy state. This is the ground state. And there are excited states. All the squares that you see here correspond to low energy states that belong to this conformal tower. What that means actually is that when we apply a geometric transformation, this state, for instance, will only mix, will be mapped into linear combination of only squares, only states in the same conformal tower. Okay? So there are three conformal towers, and what I'm saying is that these geometric transformations that we want to test should not mix different conformal towers. So if we apply one of the geometric transformations to one of these states here, say phi alpha, this is one of these states, then the geometric gate is going to map this state into a linear combination of other states, but all the states that appear in this linear combination belong to the same conformal tower. So if I start with purple, I will end up with a linear combination only of purple states. Okay? That's how a geometric transformation would act. So if we implement what we have is a true geometric gate, this is what would happen. We start, for instance, with this epsilon, as I said, okay? And we will obtain, so this epsilon state is this initial state. When we apply the gate, we will end up with a linear combination only of states in the same conformal tower, which now, if we get it right, I represent the result by in green, okay? If what we implement was not a geometric gate, then we start, say, with this state, and the result of applying this gate, which is not a geometric gate, to this state will be a linear combination of all types of low energy states. Okay? That's what we, that's our figure of merit. That's how we will know whether what we're implementing is a geometric gate or not, by looking at how this gate that we want to apply transforms a given low energy state, whether I transform it within the same conformal tower or it mixes conformal towers. Okay, so that's it. Oh yeah, so in this case what we have is that this initial state was mapped into a linear combination of guys in the same conformal tower and other guys which are not in the same conformal tower. So it's time to test this. So let's try this gate. We believe it's an Euclidean time evolution that only affects the first say 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 spins and not the rest, okay? And you see I'm using another two other tensors here, the boundaries of this local Euclidean time evolution. And there is some algorithm that I'm not gonna describe that produces these tensors. I only need to know A, and there's an algorithm that will produce these other tensors that I'll put at the end. And I'm gonna call these tensors smoothers. And this is really trying to represent a geometric gate where we go from this time slice to a time slice that looks like this. So we advance in Euclidean time, we don't advance in Euclidean time. Okay, that's what the geometric gate is trying to represent. And those who know about CFT, on the circle, this would be generated by a linear combination of L1 plus L minus 1 bar and some particular Virasoro generators. Okay, so instead of doing it in 8 spins, again, I go to 24 spins. So I act with this on 12 spins and I do nothing to the rest. And this is what happens when I target the ground state. So I apply this geometric gate to the ground state and nothing happens. The result is the ground state itself, but well, then those of you who know about CFT, they say, of course, the ground state is invariant on the global conformal transformations. This is a generator of global conformal transformations, so I should stick to the ground state. Similarly, when you apply to a stress tensor in some other state, what we see is basically that it's doing what the theory predicts. Okay, so this means that this is a way, proper way of implementing a local Euclidean time evolution on the lattice. And I have more examples, but I don't have a lot of time. So the other test, can we rescale locally our spin chain? Okay, that would be an example where here we go from a number of sites to less sites. So we are trying to compress the spins, the sites. And here we take two sites and we produce many more. And this time we start again with the Euclidean path integral tensor, just the blue ball tensor. And there are some algorithms. One is called TNR, which will produce these meta tensors. And there's another algorithm which will produce this what we have to put at the end of this local rescaling. And then we test this. And because I'm running out of time, it works nicely, okay, again. So this is, again, implementing, as we apply this type of gate to low-energy states, it's just mapping that low-energy state into a linear combination of other states in the same conformal tower. So bingo. Very good. So time for conclusions. We usually talk about tensor network having a geometry attached to it, and what I wanted to do is to try to understand, at least in concrete ways, in which sense this tensor network or parts of the tensor network can be attached to geometry or can be given a geometric meaning. So what we argue or what we show is that tensor networks can be used to represent Euclidean path integrals on curved space-time. I talked about two possible representations. There was this scale discretization representation. I talked also about the lapse and shift discretization. We've seen that tensor networks can implement these geometric transformations in the Hilbert space of the quantum spin chain, corresponding to both homogeneous Euclidean time evolution and homogeneous rescaling, but also local versions of that. And we had to introduce some small number of additional tensors, smoothers, at the end of this. Okay, and I'm just going to stop here because I wanted to tell you what the meta looks like in this perspective. But if somebody wants to know, you can ask. Thanks.
Thank you, Fred, for this very nice talk. We have plenty of time for questions.
I have two questions. So could you remind me, so in your there's a field file and in, you also have a lapse and shift. So are they globally defined or are they defined on local patches under manifold, and then there are some consistency relation between them? And my second question is that, have you ever considering like discretizing like field binds?
So let's go with the first question, which I did not understand. What's the first question?
Oh, so are they defined locally or are they defined
locally? I only worried about local. I was only able to express something simple or relatively simple in the when you consider your manifold locally. But of course, all we need additional to that is to understand how two local descriptions that overlap somewhere, how to deal with the overlap. And this will also correspond to shifts. So there is a, right, so when you have different maps, when you have different coordinate systems, usually you want some overlap between them and you need to explain how to transition from one to the other. But here we just need to explain how they transition at the boundary between them. There is no overlap, they just coincide somewhere. And this is precisely these meta tensors. This is what they are doing. They are reorganizing the degrees of freedom to go from one chart to another one.
So my second question is that, so have you ever considered like discretizing field binds instead of discretizing the metric, something like that?
Oh, this one is easy. No. I didn't try that.
I have a question. So can you see the Weyl anomaly fall out of your tensor network in some way?
Good. So it turns out that the parallelism between tensor networks and the continuum is pretty good, but precisely when it comes to when you would transform the stress tensor in a CFT, then you would have this subtraction of the central, well, the Sparsian derivative. There is some change in the way you normalize things. Well, these tensors don't lie to you. They don't allow for extra things that you would have to do on top, in the sense that there is a normalization that fails precisely. When you apply tensor network renormalization to, you can use tensor network renormalization to apply local rescalings. And everything goes through, so that the final object, if you compute correlators on the final curves, geometry that you get, the two-point correlators are correct. And there is only one scale factor, there is one global scale that is not in place, which has to do with Weyl anomaly. I can tell you more about this later.
So if there's a parallelism between path integrals and tensor networks, does this mean that path integral Monte Carlo basically becomes a tensor network Monte Carlo? Is there a connection to now with PIMC?
Path integral Monte Carlo?
So basically it's, I'm sampling along the world lines in imaginary time, right?
Yes.
So it's like Monte Carlo, but I did a sample along the world line.
Okay, so there are two pieces here. One is we discretize, right? And in Monte Carlo, I'm assuming you don't need to do that. I mean, you sample discretely, but you stay con. So space and time, or Euclidean time, do not need to be discretized. So that's an important difference. Yeah.
Thank you.
Okay, I have an observation and a question. Observation is that somehow your technique seems to have been crucially tied to a 2D space.
Yes.
And the question this motivates is there, apart from having a mapping between sort of a tensor network and a 2D geometry, are we supposed to extract some sort of a overarching lesson for when that mapping is possible, you know, something good happens or something?
Okay, I always get confused. There was an observation and a question. So
The question is, what is the lesson from this?
Okay, thanks. So that sounds like a pretty open question, and I want to use it to tell you about what I couldn't say. All right, so let's see. This was tied to two dimensions because two dimensions are easier. But I
also flat.
Right, which I used in one of the characterizations. But the point, my point was to try to understand, to give some type of geometrical meaning to tensor networks, to tensor networks that we've been playing around with for several years now. And so I was happy if I could give some interpretation to the two-dimensional case. And maybe it's not easy to extend that to higher dimensions, or there will be situations where this won't work. But for me, it's nice enough that now I can say, oh, Meta is not an Euclidean path integral in an expanding universe or something like that. And so answering your open question, the last conclusion from this talk is that Meta corresponds to something that I'm going to call rescaling without Euclidean time evolution. Okay, so if I consider tensor networks and I want to understand from an Euclidean path integral perspective, what do they correspond to? I could define, say, this a sequence of tensor networks that interpolate between the Euclidean time evolution and the Meta. Okay, and in between, I put as a representative this object where I have some Euclidean time evolution followed by rescaling, then Euclidean time evolution, rescaling, and so on. Right. So this thing corresponds to Euclidean time evolution. And I'm going to call this Euclidean path integral in flat spacetime. Okay. So the geometry here is flat spacetime. There is only Euclidean time evolution. But this object, this mixture object here, is mixing this Euclidean time evolution with this change of a scale, this layer of meta tensors, which correspond basically to the exponential of the dilation operator. And so in this case, I would say that this is a discrete version of an Euclidean path integral in hyperbolic space. Okay. So it contains both Euclidean time evolution and rescaling. And then Meta is only the rescaling. From this perspective, Meta is just the limit of shifting around without advancing in Euclidean time. Okay. So it's only rescaling. There is no Euclidean time evolution, and so that's the way I understand MIR. It's a big change of basis, right? It's if you take the exponential of the dilation operator, or if you consider an evolution by the dilation operator, then you know this is not an exponential. This is not a Hamiltonian evolution. It's just rescaling everything all the time. In MIR, on top of that, it has to do with the UV cutoff, and it gets a bit more involved. But it's basically the lattice version of changing scale, and that's it.
Yeah. So, question. Given a tensor network can represent the path integral, and you showed if you have a metric or some geometry, you can represent this by a tensor network as well. And at some point, you flash the action of a field on a certain metric, but you didn't. So if I take my does the tensor network that with the tensor constructed from the field theory and with the geometry given by the metric, will that implement the path integral of that field in that metric? You didn't.
All right. So in the end, I don't make the blue ball, this tensor. I don't start from a field theory. In principle, one could take literally take a patch of Euclidean time evolution, mm-hmm. right? Or path integral, Euclidean path integral. You will regularize it in some way so that its boundary of the square has only a finite number of field configurations. And take that, you know, put for a choice of four field configurations of the boundary, you would get a number which corresponds to the exponential of the Euclidean path integral of the Euclidean action, right? And that will be your blue tensor, and you could grant this theorem. But in practice, we don't do that. Nobody cares enough. So we start with the criticalizing model as a much simpler example, and we run the whole program with starting directly from the lattice.
Can I ask another question? Since I'm holding the mic. But I mean, of course, people do that in lattice QCD. And so can we do this to lattice QCD and get a much easier way to, you know, get wave functions than that way, which is what they're doing now?
So that sounds very exciting until I remind you that it's two dimensions. Right. So yes, in two dimensions, we know that we can do better than Monte Carlo sampling. Right. But the big question is, can we go to 2+1 or 3+1? So four dimensions, and that's where, yeah, maybe someday.
So could you perhaps comment on the relationship of this to the work of Takenagi and collaborators, where basically they say you start with the Euclidean path integral that looks like that figure on the left, but then you do some conformal transformation to try to minimize sort of the volume per cell of the path integral, and then they end up sort of arriving at a picture where you say you do the path integral in hyperbolic space, and sort of each cell is kind of like the continuous version of a tensor. It seems quite simple, similar. But there, in the end, you could still say it's something like Monte Carlo. It's just Monte Carlo, where instead of studying the theory, you know, on the Euclidean plane, you're studying it on sort of half, you know, hyperbolic space in order to sort of, with a minimal complexity, generate the right ground state.
Right. So there appears to be some contradiction between what I said here, where this is not an Euclidean path integral, and the conclusion of that work.
Yeah.
Yes. I look forward to understanding, this better. Yes.
If I ask you when you're not in front of everyone, would you say something?
So I don't think that this is an Euclidean path integral, and therefore, you know, I would like to understand in which sense it's being claimed to be an Euclidean path integral. So this you know, the Euclidean path integral part is being shifted up, so you keep coordinating this object. You push the Euclidean time evolution to larger and larger distances, and at some point you forget about it. And MIR is the result of forgetting about the Euclidean path integral. So I probably don't agree with the conclusions of that work, but I want to discuss it.
Yes, I have a question about exactly this picture. So if you go from the Euclidean particle to the Mira, it feels not very natural that these gates have to be unitary. So how does that emerge there, that indeed in the Mira you get actually these isometries, that you get isometries and not just arbitrary gates?
Well, that's precisely again the same, that what we're doing here in Mira is we are reorganizing the degrees of freedom. It's a change of variables.
But from this picture, you could as well put an arbitrary tensor there, no? Not just a unitary one.
Right. No. From the beginning, these tensors, the tensors I've been testing, were unitary. So when I tested gates, local gates generated by these guys, these were, let's see if I can find it. So all these tests, right, concluding testing that these gates up there transform the low-energy such space as if they were geometric gates. That was for a particular choice of these tensors, which were coming from an optimized meta. So they were unitary. So in this talk, every time I was drawing blue balls, those are not unitary, but the meta tensors are unitary.
So I have a question. So is there a way in which you have control over the normalization of the state that you're producing with this path integral or the normalization of the path integral?
So you start with the tensor network. It will have some norm. If you manipulate it by shifts only, then the norm will be maintained. So basically, it's related to a previous question. The Weyl anomaly doesn't show in these manipulations. You have to put it by hand.
OK, so if there are no further questions, we have a break. And we'll thank Giffrey again.